it seems that Dubose is about to angle off the brink and down, Jurgen says, "Wait, wait, it's too precipitous here. Go west a little way."
"It's not too precipitous," Dubose says.
"Yes, it is," Jurgen insists.
"Don't go fully pussy on me."
This bumpkin's cloddish rudeness offends Jurgen. "I've never gone fully pussy in my life."
"Maybe not, but you've got the tendency," says Dubose,
and drives off the brink, onto the precipitous slope, along which they descend at such a perilous angle, rollicking over such forbidden terrain that the night vision picture, already alien to the eye, becomes a meaningless jumble of leaping shapes in shades of green, as if they are hapless characters in an outer space movie rocketing through a meteor storm. To prove his mettle, Jurgen never cries out on the way down, nor does he reach for the grab bar above the door, nor does he raise his feet to brace himself against the dashboard. He relies solely on his harness, even though at moments it seems the truck has slipped the bonds of gravity and that he will float out of his seat. 5. Velociraptor hulking on the deep canyon floor, engine off, both front windows open, and to the port side, silhouettes of trees, and then the stream like magma pouring from a wound in the earth. Such a scene as a sleeper might imagine after a highly spiced dinner. Night air wafting cool into the truck, the chuckle and susurration of fast-moving water, a sweet licorice-like fragrance evidently issuing from some plant along the stream's edge, and the fainter limey scent of wet stone, all things green on green with shadows deep. Dubose has parked about 300 yards from where the helo is hovering and has switched off the engine. He says,
"They know they've been found, so if they were going to give up, they'd have shown themselves already. We've got to take the boy alive, but with the other two, we only make our best effort."
Instructions were all three alive. Inject the Washingtons and interrogate them.
"Thanks for refreshing my memory," Dubose replies with heavy irony. "But these two, they'll be better armed than anyone in your average Quentin Tarantino movie."
"Maybe they will be. On the other hand, with the boy to think about, maybe they won't."
"They're ex-military. They'll have a damn arsenal. And with their training, they won't be pushovers."
"We've been trained, too," Jurgen says.
"Law enforcement training and Army Special Forces training are different worlds. You read this tough bastard's service record? And the bitch lost both legs from the knees down, but still competes in marathons."
10K runs, Jurgen corrects. "Not marathons anymore." Again, with the unnecessary irony, Dubose says,
"Oh, that's a whole different story then. What kind of wimp is the bitch, able to run just 10K without legs?"
"Let's say they are carrying big time."
"We don't have to say it. They are carrying."
"If this turns into a firefight, how do we avoid killing the boy? Collateral damage."
"To keep the kids safe, they don't want a firefight," Dubose says. "So they'll try to get the drop on us and take our weapons or pull some other cute shit. All I'm saying is, they'll hesitate, and we won't. Blow the shit out of them on sight."
"What if they're using the boy as a shield?"
"Man, to get a degree from Harvard, do they make you minor in cynicism? These aren't the kind of people who use little kids as shields."
"People are never the kind of people you think they are."
"Then there's every reason to blow the shit out of them on sight."
They get out of the Velociraptor and close the doors. The chopper is hovering high enough above the trees to avoid being an easy target, but it remains stationed over the heat source to guide the ground team and to unnerve the Washingtons with noise. Jurgen and Dubose are armed with belt-carried 9mm Sig Sauer pistols, but not with rifles, because this is going to be a close-up fight, if it is any fight at all. Thigh-high waterside grass and a variety of trees, which Jurgen can't identify in the current light, offer them what cover they will have. The helicopter is an adapted civilian model medium twin craft with high-set main and tail rotors, and it produces enough noise to cover any sounds they might make. The stream is about 12 feet wide. There must be a high concentration of calcium carbonate in the runoff from these hills, because over decades the seasonal rains have laid down a flowstone bed, accounting for the smooth, swift movement of the water, which proves to be about 2 feet deep when Dubose wades to the farther bank. Because the night lacks stars and is brightened only by cloud-filtered moonlight, Jurgen doesn't expect the darkness to be much deeper under the trees, but it is. Without the NVGs, they would be nearly blind. Given Gavin Washington's background, there is a possibility that he is equipped with goggles of his own, though they won't be mil-spec Generation 4 gear with 80,000 amplification, but rather Generation 1 Plus. Hunter and hobbyist models ranging from a few $100 to a couple $1,000s will not serve Washington nearly as well as their headsets will serve them. Jurgen and Dubose proceed at a matched pace, moving from tree to tree, pistols in a two-hand grip. They are wary of the tall grass and the trees ahead, which offer cover to the Washingtons if they have chosen to get out of their vehicle and establish a forward position in an attempt to set a trap. This is unlikely. For one thing, they will assume that their body heat will betray them, and chances are they will stay with the boy. They have been counting on the cool water of the stream and the canopy of trees to mask the rover's heat signature. Now that they realize this ruse didn't work, they won't have had time to plan another. In retrospect, Dubose's preference for killing the Washingtons on sight in favor of capturing just the boy does not seem to be as ill-considered as Jurgen first thought. He certainly doesn't want to die here tonight, or anywhere on any night. Better to act first and decisively. All they really need is the boy. With him, they will have Jane Hawk by the short hairs. Ahead, the Land Rover comes into view, parked in the middle of the stream, the cooling water flowing over its bumper and around its flanks, glowing with otherworldly light above the waterline, as if it is a phantom coach that conveys the spirits of the dead to their reward. They are now within the perimeter of the helo's downdraft. The trees thrash overhead, spinning off leaves that shudder through the green dark like huge moths, and the tall grasses shiver, and the turbulent air beats shapes into the surface of the stream that was heretofore as smooth as glass. They're 30 yards from the Land Rover. Now 20. 15. The windshield is a darker rectangle in the bright green of the vehicle. Beyond the glass, there are no warm shapes of people, as though the rover has been abandoned. If the Washingtons have foolishly set out on foot with the boy in this forbidding territory, they can't have gotten far. The trees might mask their smaller heat signatures from aerial surveillance, but there will be breaks in the canopy through which they will sooner or later be sighted. And eventually, there won't be any trees at all. 10 yards. And now Jurgen and Dubose are in the very eye of the downdraft, where the air is calmer, although the engine roar and the whoomp, whoomp, whoomp of the rotary wing are louder than ever. Perhaps it is only the tidal crash of rhythmic sound resonating in the hollows of Jurgen's bones, but suddenly he shudders with the suspicion that they have walked into a trap after all. 6. Gavin was slumped down in the driver's seat. The single lens of the ATN PVS-7-3 goggles, which fed a gathered image to both eyes, was aimed through the thick spokes of the steering wheel and just over the top of the dashboard, so that he presented little or no heat profile separate from that of the rover. From this uncomfortable position, he saw the men appear out of the gloom, one on each side of the stream, pistols at the ready, and he watched them approach through the wind-tossed vegetation. Travis had put the briefcase full of money and Jesse's Blade Runner prosthetics on the back seat, and he had taken refuge on the floor, where the dogs cuddled with him. Jesse was in the cargo area, which the Shepherds had occupied previously. She was sitting propped against the back of the back seat, below window level. Gavin had switched off the engine when they had first driven into the stream, hoping that the cooling flow and the sheltering trees might blind the chopper to them. When that hadn't worked, He had started the engine again and prepared to make a break for it when the moment was right. In the roar of the helicopter, the men approaching along the banks of the stream would not be able to hear the Land Rover. They might assume the engine wasn't running or that the vehicle was abandoned. When the gunman drew as close as Gavin dared to let them get before taking action, he shifted the idling vehicle into drive. The pressure of the rushing water prevented the Rover from drifting forward, so that the thugs were not alerted until he popped up in his seat and tramped the accelerator. For an instant, the big tires spun on the flowstone bed of the stream, but then the Land Rover surged forward. The assassins startled and hesitated for but a moment, which brought the Rover almost even with them before they opened fire. Three muzzle flares, two on the right. A bullet barked off the roof panel above the windshield. Another knocked a side mirror cockeyed. Maybe the third went wide. Even as they were firing, Gavin gave them a blast of the horn, which might have further startled them, but which was primarily meant to be a signal to Jesse. 7. Seated in the cargo area, back pressed to the back seat, Jesse faced the open tailgate, shotgun ready. When the horn blared all but simultaneously with the gunfire and they kept moving, she could only suppose that Gavin hadn't been hit, thank God, and that they were already passing the gunman. In the immediate echo of the horn, as plumes of water flared up from the back tires and chopper downdraft cast a cold spray into the cargo area, Jesse squeezed off the first of four rounds, unable to see any target, intending only to make the gunman drop flat and hold their fire in the Land Rover's wake, muzzle flare for an instant glittering in thousands of airborne droplets, recoil bucking her against the bracing seat back. Few things equaled the thunder crack of a 12-gauge to make sober men duck and cover, and by the time she squeezed off the second, third, and fourth rounds, the Rover was so far upstream she didn't feel in danger from their pistol fire. Ears ringing, half-deaf for the moment, Jesse resorted to the open box of shells between her thighs to slip a round in the breech and three more in the tube magazine. 8. The German Shepherds were good dogs, but they were howling now in the back seat, protesting the painful volume of shotgun blasts in such a contained space, and Gavin sympathized, his ears ringing as though he'd been slapped hard up both sides of his head. He shouted to Travis, his voice sounding as if it came from the far end of a culvert. The boy shouted back, just loud enough to be heard. He was okay, and Jesse gave a shout-out, too. The blackish trees beyond the reach of the helo's downdraft stood as still as if petrified to stone in another millennium, and on his left he came to a break in their palisade and swung out of the stream, over the low grassy bank, onto the canyon floor. 50 yards ahead stood some model of truck he'd never seen before, even though, as he closed on it, he could make out the word Ford in large letters across the grill. If there had been three men with the truck, one remaining behind, it might be a mistake to stop, but he didn't think there was a third. He didn't see anyone. He braked beside the Ford, threw open his door, and drew his Springfield 45. He emptied the magazine into the two rear tires on the driver's side, blowing out both, a couple rounds ricocheting off the alloy wheels. Distorted reflections of the bright green muzzle flashes quivering through the glossy black paint like some aurora borealis in an evil netherworld. He ejected the empty magazine, slapped in a new one, closed his door, holstered the warm pistol, and drove east at high speed. The gunmen were on foot now, and no longer an immediate threat, but the helicopter was giving chase. Gavin came to a place where the trees relented on both sides of the stream. Beyond the sinuous slide of water, the south wall of the canyon looked lower and less steep than the north wall, offering what appeared to be a clear route to the top. He forded the stream and motored up an incline of grass. The ground was still soft from recent rains and moist below the first couple inches, and he gouged out muddy tracks all the way to the crest. On the higher ground, the helicopter came at them from the west. It was a civilian helo, large enough to carry 6 or 8 passengers in addition to the crew, if it had not been retrofitted for another purpose. It bore no agency ID that he could see in the drowned light of the NVGs. Maybe the pilot had been military in an earlier career, but maybe he was just a chopper jockey who had no service training, no war experience. The latter seemed to be the case when he swooped in no more than 50 feet above the rover, as though to intimidate the driver, which was a hopeless cause. But even if they weren't ex-military, the pilot and his co-pilot might be more than just aerial search specialists assisting a hard-boiled ground crew. If the co-pilot was a trained sniper, or if a sniper was aboard, that might justify a lower approach in order to take out the vehicle without accidentally killing anyone aboard. No doubt the people trying to find Jane would prefer to interrogate Gavin and Jesse rather than kill them, and at all costs take Travis alive. Or maybe their intent was to spook him with one dangerous feint after another, using the helicopter much as a matador used a red cape to thwart a bull, distracting and delaying him long enough for the ground crew to scale the canyon wall and re-engage. The Hilo racketed east through the night, looped around to the south, and approached them again. When he realized the aircraft was coming in as low as before, maybe even lower, as though to skid-kiss the roof of the Land Rover, Gavin braked to a stop. He glanced over his shoulder and saw Jesse scrambling out of the open tailgate. She closed it behind her and crouched at the back of the vehicle. Ghostly celebrants seemed to spring from graves as the Hilo passed over the land, billows of dust and chaff shapen into dancers that whirled away into the haunted dark. The blades of the rotary wing carved slabs of air and threw them down to rock the rover on its tires. As the chopper passed at reckless altitude, Jesse fired the shotgun 3 times in quick succession, and then pulled off a 4th round aimed at its tail rotor. This wasn't a movie, so the aircraft did not burst into flames, as there was no reason that it should. But a knocking noise and the sharp keening of metal parts grinding against each other at high speed suggested that she'd done some damage. The pilot arced west and south, away from the canyon, and the Hilo yawed as it gained a little altitude. Jesse opened the front passenger door and boarded the rover, and Gavin set out after the helicopter as she slammed her door. He had no intention of giving pursuit for any purpose other than to keep it in sight, until he knew whether it was seriously disabled. Whatever mechanical problem a few loads of point-blank buckshot might have caused, it quickly metastasized into a crisis. The pilot ceased lateral flight and hovered and started to put down, the rotary wings stuttering. When the Hilo was about 40 feet off the ground, its blades locked. Without lift, it dropped hard, snapped a skid, tipped, and came to rest canted to starboard, propped at an angle by wing blades. Gavin stripped off his night vision goggles and gave them to Jesse. He switched on the headlights. The pale land and dark scrub seemed to leap at them out of a void, the green world gone, this more familiar world stabilizing under them. Travis scrambled off the floor onto the back seat when Jesse told him to belt up. He tried his best to do so with the dogs half atop him and excitedly licking his hands and face. Keeping in mind the possibility of gunfire, Gavin drove wide of the downed aircraft. However, the sidewash of the rover's high beams revealed one man on his knees beside the craft and another in the open cockpit door above, getting ready to jump. The hills unveiled their contours more readily to headlights than to the amplified moonlight and infrared of the NVGs. Gavin oriented himself as best he could as Jesse read aloud the compass heading, and then he drove south-southwest through the wildlands faster than he had dared in a green world. The tremors took him then. Not for long, not violently enough to make his teeth chatter. If there had been a cold sweat on his brow and down his back before this, he didn't realize it until now. In spite of how practiced Jesse had been in both showdowns, Gavin knew that she was shaken too when she said, "Afghanistan used to be half a world away. I liked it better there." 9. Jane Hawk allowed herself far fewer superstitions than did most people, one of which was that long goodbyes were more likely to be final goodbyes than were short ones. Better to say, until next time, or see you soon, than to say goodbye at any length. Behind the mortuary, beside her explorer sport, in the chilly darkness of 3:30 Sunday morning, Jane said to Gilberto Mendez, "See you soon," and she thanked him, and she told him that she loved him. It was her conviction, not superstition, that this civilization was built on love, on the love of people for one another, and on the love that surpasseth all understanding. In this age of cynicism and snark, genuine emotion was mocked, love derided as sentimentalism. In this world of rapid change, there were few things to which you could hold fast. Wisdom acquired through centuries of experience, traditions, and beloved neighborhoods eroded and washed away, and with them went the people who found solace and meaning in those things, who once would have been part of your life for most of your life. Now, a rootless population, believing in nothing but the style and fashion of the moment, produced a culture of surface conformity, under which the reality was a loveless realm in which soon everyone would live as a stranger in a strange land. When you loved enough important qualities of a person, then you loved him or her, and you had better say it while time remained. She loved Gilberto's faithfulness to Carmela, his devotion to his children, his respect for the dignity of the dead and for the eternal nature of their souls, his love of freedom, and his lifelong commitment to the marine way, to Semper Fi. Therefore, her goodbye consisted of just those 8 heartfelt words. "See you soon. Thank you. I love you." She hugged him and kissed him on the cheek. At 3:31, she was on the road in her SUV that had been rebuilt in Mexico, wearing the chopped every which way Vogue punk black wig and the eyeshadow and the blue lipstick and the nose ring that went with the photo on the Elizabeth Bennett driver's license. In the passenger seat was Booth Hendrickson, still under her control because she had accessed him by saying, "Play Manchurian with me," and had not released him with the words, "Auf Wiedersehen." She believed in the efficacy of the control mechanism, even in his case. Nevertheless, for this first leg of the journey, his wrists were bound together with a zip tie that also looped through his belt, so that he could not lift his hands from his lap. He wore his suit, but a too roomy shirt belonging to Gilberto had replaced his custom-tailored shirt from which Jane had earlier cut one arm when preparing him for injection. He wore no tie. Before having his hands encumbered by his belt, he had nervously fingered his buttoned collar and had appeared distressed that his outfit remained incomplete. Heading east toward San Bernardino, she didn't speak to him, nor he to her. For the first half hour, she welcomed the silence, the time to think about what lay ahead and how best to cope with it. But soon, the man's servile obedience to her preference for quiet, his placid expression unchanging mile by mile, and his dead-eyed stare that never wavered from the dark road ahead, all that became too eerie for her to countenance. Since she still had nothing to say to him, she opted for music. She wanted no trackable GPS in any car she acquired, but she always needed a vast store of music, which, not unpleasantly, reminded her of the life she might have lived if her father had not murdered her mother so many years ago. In recent days, she had found herself listening more often to Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 3 in A Major, K-488, in part because the concerto's opening movement inspired a soaring optimism that was much needed in her current circumstances. Within this exceptional concerto, however, was a melancholy movement so piercing, so expressive of the deepest sorrow, that she couldn't hear it without thinking about Nick and her mother, and about Nathan Silverman, who had once been her boss at the FBI, and whom she had spared from a life of Arcadian slavery by an act of loving violence that would weigh upon her forever. This sequence in K-488 didn't depress her, but balanced the optimism of the opening movement and made her feel complete of heart and clear of mind. As that movement was nearing an end, Hendrickson violated her instruction to remain silent, but only to say, "It's so beautiful." "Yes."
"What is it?"
she told him.
"I was allowed no time for music."
She considered that statement for a moment before she said, "You'll have it now, all the way to Tahoe, one music or another." He said only, "Thank you," gazing at the highway with the stony expression of a sphinx whose stare was fixed on the rim of eternity. When the slow movement of K-488 passed, Jane was relieved to hear again more thrilling strains of dauntless optimism. 10. North, on U.S. Highway 395, through the western portion of the Mojave, a vast blackness all around, the clouds of the coast having surrendered the sky to stars, the moon far down. Later, dawn frosting the heavens with light, first a sweet rose pink at the horizon, a paler pink farther up, and a swath of buttercream before all goes blue for the day. Lonely playas of salt flats and mud flats and sand flats, forbidding dark mountains in the distance. There was Mozart again, Eine kleine Nachtmusik, when Jane at last brought up the subject that Hendrickson had not wanted to talk about until he was under her control. He had asked that, after he'd spoken of it, she would order him to forget that he had told her about this thing that apparently mortified him. "I think to myself, I play to myself, and nobody knows what I say to myself. What did you mean by that, Booth?" His smile was pained, but at least it counted as a smile. He spoke with a note of nostalgic fondness that didn't displace his melancholy, staring at the highway, but perhaps seeing into the past.
"So, here I am in the dark alone. There's nobody here to see. I think to myself, I play to myself, and nobody knows what I say to myself. It's from a book. Poems. A little book of poems."
"What book?"
"Now We Are Six by A.A. Milne. But I was just 5.
After a moment of consideration, Jane said, "The author of Winnie the Pooh." "What does that mean to you?"
"The books? They're everything. They mean everything to me."
"You could read at 5?
"She pushes me to read. She pushes, pushes, pushes."
"Your mother?"
"Lessons all day, every day."
His brow pleated, and his eyes narrowed, and his voice hardened. "Focus, boy! Focus if you know what's good for you, boy! Focus, 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 you lazy little bastard!" She waited until his quickened breathing quieted. "So you read the book of poems when you were 5.
"I'm given the set. All 4 Milne books. To encourage me."
"Encourage you to read?"
"To read more. Faster. Better. To understand what's wrong."
"Wrong with what?"
"With everyone in the story. Like the bear. He's stupid and lazy. He's not focused. And he's kind."
"It's wrong to be kind?"
"He's gentle and kind. Kindness is weakness. The strong own the world. The strong use the weak. They piss on the weak. They should piss on them. It's what the weak deserve."
His face contorted with contempt, and his voice became harsh again.
"Is that what you want, boy? Do you want to be used and pissed on all your miserable life?"
Out in the wasteland, Dead Man's Dry Lake and Lost Dry Lake and Owl Dry Lake, the lava mountains ahead, Death Valley at a distance in the east. Passing through the desert, Jane felt as if something of the desert were passing into her. But what do those lines of poetry mean to you, those lines in particular?
Mother says the only worthwhile life is a regimented life. Make a schedule. Stick to it. It's a very bad boy who can't stick to it. No day is a good day if it isn't regimented.
Jane waited, but after a silence said, And so?
And so. 15 minutes for breakfast, 15 for lunch, 30 minutes for dinner, to bed at 8, up at 5, lights out at 8, out, out, out!
Only 2 lamps in the room. She takes the light bulbs, takes them with her, takes them after I'm put to bed. So here I am in the dark alone. He nodded.
There's nobody here to see.
The poem is in the dark.
So I take a book to the window. Sometimes there's moonlight, or landscape lights from outside. I can see the page if I turn it just so. For an hour or two until I get sleepy, I can think what I want, play what I want. My time. In all the day, it's my own time.
Jane said, If she opened your bedroom door and found you not asleep but reading by moonlight, what then?
So then, the deeper darkness.
And what was that?
At first, it's being made naked and being spanked. Spanked on my
boy thing.
Spanked hard so it hurts to pee. You're not going to be like your father, boy, not like that worthless piece of shit.
So I'm spanked and put in the box to sleep the rest of the night.
The box?
What box?
A wood box. It has a locking lid. A box the size of the boy. With a folded blanket to lie on. Holes to let air in. But no light. No light, 'cause the box is in a closet with no windows.
Dear God, she said. You don't need a God if Mother loves you. Mother is all you need. Mother punishes out of love to teach what's true and right. In the arid landscape, geologic formations like crude, time-worn temples by gods better left unworshipped, giant rocks graven with pictographs by tribes known and by others too ancient to have names other than those that anthropologists have chosen to give them. How often were you locked in a box?
2 nights a week, or 3. So then I start sleeping early and getting up at like 2 in the morning, after she's sleeping.
Then you could read by moonlight.
Yes, and not be caught.
You said at first it was being made naked and spanked and put in the box, and later it was...
Worse. Later, worse. Later, it's the crooked staircase.
Previously, he told her and Gilberto all about the crooked staircase. Soon, they will descend it together. 11. In the last of the night, Gavin had stopped one sage-covered hill away from Highway 76. While boy and dogs lay in a slumberous pile on the back seat, while Jesse held a light for Gavin, while unseen canyon wrens, waking early, whistled sweetly in anticipation of the dawn, he took the license plates off the Land Rover and replaced them with plates that Jane had given him weeks earlier. She had also provided registration papers and a driver's license in the name of Orlando Gibbons, as well as a license for Jessica in the name of Elizabeth Hafner, obtained from her source for forgeries in Reseda. Those documents would pass the scrutiny of any cop who ran them through the DMV records. They needed to repaint the Rover, make it the blue that was stipulated on the registration, but they were prepared to do that when they reached their destination. Likewise, Gavin and Jesse would need to alter some things about their appearance to match the photoshopped pictures used for the forgeries. At the moment, however, it was most important to strip the Rover of the original plates, which might already be on the National Crime Information Center website, before traveling on paved roads once more. They couldn't risk their old plates being automatically scanned by government vehicles because those scans would soon thereafter be banked in the NSA archives, allowing them to be found and tracked, at least to the general vicinity of the one safe hold they had prepared for such an emergency as this. Using a collapsible spade from a kit of basic tools that they kept in the rover, Gavin dug a hole and dropped the original license plates into it. He covered them with earth and tamped it down and scuffed the burial place with his boots. He examined his work in the beam of Jesse's flashlight. It looked fine. No one was likely to wander onto precisely this square yard of remote wildland. If searchers chanced by, they would never notice the telltales of this small excavation, and even if they did notice and dug up the plates, their pursuit of Travis would in no way be furthered by that discovery. Nevertheless, Gavin tore off a few stems of sage and used the foliage to brush away anything that looked like a boot impression. In the backwash of the flashlight, Jesse smiled. "You really love him, don't you?"
"Woman, I love you, I love him, I love the dogs, I love me, I love life, and I hate the people who think we're just part of the great unwashed who need to be taught some manners."
"Give me a kiss," she said.
"What, here?"
"If it's too public for you, I'll turn out the light," which she did. He kissed her, and she kissed back,
and he said, "I've been wondering how Elizabeth Hafner kisses. She's got the mojo."
"Hmm. So does Orlando Gibbons." As dawn broke, with the boy snoring and the dogs whimpering in their dreams of rabbit chasing, Gavin drove over one last rugged hill and up a slope onto a lonely stretch of Highway 76. He switched on the headlights again and headed southeast toward Lake Henshaw, and then Borrego Valley, which was surrounded by Anza Borrego Desert State Park, there to take refuge with one who called himself a walking nut bar. 12. And in the vast wasteland were bones, those of wild burros and of coyotes that had strayed too far from hospitable terrain, bleached to the white of salt and pitted by weather. Also, the centuries-old bones of men and women in unmarked ancient graves or massed in as yet undiscovered caves where barbaric slaughter had occurred, and as previously in such caves, the bones of children, too, with caved-in skulls. Behind the wheel of the Explorer Sport, Jane said, "Something else I remember you saying. Now, is it true or is it not?" Hendrickson finished the line.
"That what is which, and which is what?"
"Is that also Milne?"
"The first Winnie book. A poem called Lines Written by a Bear of Very Little Brain."
"It means something special to you?" He stared at the ribbon of highway, which seemed to pull them along with it as it was raveled onto some distant spool. After a minute, he said,
"What is which, but which is what? Those are these, but these are those. Who is what, but what is who?" "That's the way the world is, you weak, ignorant boy. People aren't ever who they seem to be, and nothing they say means what it seems to mean. Nothing is only what it is. If you want to survive, you pathetic little shit, you damn well better understand. You better learn the need to be strong like me. Learn to crush anyone who gets in your way. Don't be like your worthless dick of a father. Go down the hole and learn, boy. Down the hole you go. Down the hole."
He sat, trembling, sheathed in sweat. To the east, the naval weapons station at China Lake, and to the west, the beginning of the Inyo National Forest and rising ranks of pinyon pines. High overhead, an unusually large flock of common ravens with wingspans over 4 feet glided without the need to oar the air. Jane was reminded of an Indian legend that told of the ravens that had pulled the first light of the world into the sky with their beaks. It was said that one day they would appear in great numbers long before sunset and pull into the world the final and everlasting darkness. This seemed as if it might be the day for that, but the only blackness in the blue was the flock itself, which winged onward, each member an indecipherable cryptograph, sent into flight by a creation that teased with meaning, but held tightly its secrets. She said, "Booth, when I snap my fingers, you will forget we ever had a conversation about Milne and the Pooh books. You will forget my questions and what you said in answer to them. The most recent thing we spoke about was Mozart. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
She took one hand from the wheel and snapped her fingers. Although time would pass before his perspiration dried, his tremors ceased. The anxiety faded from his face. He relaxed in the passenger seat, staring straight ahead, as though his mind traveled the byways of a daydream. Jane couldn't imagine what phantasms and contrivances his reverie might contain, but she suspected that it was of such a character that the ravens of the everlasting night were a part of it, and that in the shadows of its twisting streets there would be a maternal figure who had programmed him long before the nanomachine control mechanism had been invented. 13. The small town of Borrego Springs, in the Borrego Valley, in San Diego County, surrounded by 600,000 acres of the Anza-Borrego Desert State Park, was not one of the top 20 tourist attractions in California. Most of those who vacationed there were campers, and even those who stayed in the town's motels and motor inns were drawn by activities related to the desert. A week from now, perhaps sooner, the largest crowd of the year would arrive to witness the spring flowering of the desert, when thousands of acres blazed with intricate configurations of blooming annuals, red poppies, zinnia in many hues, deep purple gentians, and a rich variety of wildflowers that transformed the stark meadows and spread into the distance like some immense random pattern Persian carpet woven by artisans in a state of euphoria. Gavin and Jesse's destination wasn't within the town limits, but farther down valley, off County Road S-22. Two unpaved ruts with a stubble of dead weeds between them served as a driveway to the 5-acre property. The single-story pale blue stucco house, in need of paint, stood in a grove of ragged queen palms under a white metal roof, surrounded by a yard of pea gravel and specimen cacti. Cement block steps led to a front porch barren of furniture. Cornell Jasperson, owner of the property, didn't live in the house. No one lived there, though it was fully furnished. Cornell's residence was 100 yards behind the house, in a subterranean structure with thick steel-reinforced concrete walls and ceiling, which he'd designed and built without obtaining permits, perhaps by greasing a lot of palms, he would not say, and by using his connection to import Philippine workers who'd lived in trailers on site, never went into town, and spoke only Tagalog. The structure was buried under 4 feet of earth and beyond detection, known only to Cornell, Gavin, and 12 newly rich Philippine workers who had returned home years earlier, telling stories prepared for them, stories regarding what it was like to spend a year working 12-hour days in Utah, helping to build a mansion for a wealthy eccentric named John Beresford Tipton. Of connections, Cornell had many, the least powerful being his cousin, his mother's sister's son, Gavin Washington. Born out of wedlock, Cornell had never known his father. His mother, Shamira, had been a drug addict and sometimes prostitute, who named him after the man who, by her best judgment, was her co-conceiver. Shamira and her family disowned each other when she was 16. She died of a drug overdose 20 years later when Cornell was just 18. No one in the family even knew of his existence. By the time he was 24, from the proceeds of 10 apps of his creation, He had been worth more than $300 million. The rapid accumulation of wealth, in his words, scared the bejesus out of him. By his reckoning, something was out of whack when a walking nut bar like me can go from a net worth of $10 to $300 million in 4 years. His success had convinced him that current society was a mouse of cards and that he needed to bunker down and ride out the coming Apocageddon. Cornell's description of himself as a nut bar was too harsh by far. He had been diagnosed variously as suffering from Asperger's disorder and different degrees of autism, among other things, and some people whose education came from movies called him an idiot savant, though his IQ was exceptional. It could be said with certainty only that Cornell was eccentric, but most likely harmless. Gavin drove around the house, following the ruts that led past the yard of pea gravel and ended in a turnaround in front of a barn, standing between the house and the undetectable bunker that was buried under 4 feet of earth. The barn looked as though it might collapse if sneezed on. Sun, wind, and rain had weathered the unpainted wood into a palette of grays. The structure's north and south walls were concave, and the whole thing canted to the west under a rust-streaked metal roof.
"Does he have horses?" Travis asked from the back seat.
"No," Gavin said. "He wouldn't know what to do with a horse."
"Does he have dogs?"
"No, he wouldn't trust himself to take care of one properly."
"Does he have chickens?" Jesse asked, mischievously, as if likewise possessed by the curiosity of a 5-year-old.
"Does he have pigs and sheep?"
Gavin pinched Jesse's earlobe affectionately and said to Travis,
"He lives here all by himself. No animals, no other people."
"That's sad," the boy said.
"Not as far as Cornell's concerned. This is exactly the way he wants things."
Although Cornell had no one after his mother died, he'd made no effort to be taken into the fold of his family. Instead, years later, when he was wealthy, he quietly researched his relatives and chose one of them, Gavin, to whom he felt comfortable reaching out. Even though the two of them lived but a couple hours from each other, and though Cornell had once suggested that he'd settled here for just that reason, Gavin was welcome to visit no more than once a month. He didn't know why Cornell favored him, and no other. If he bluntly asked why, he wouldn't get an answer. He might even be put on the not-welcome list for his temerity. The only way that Cornell talked about personal matters was at his election, and indirectly. Gavin put down the windows and switched off the engine and said,
"I'll go in alone and have a little chat with him. See if he wants to say hello."
"Does he have cows?"
Jesse asked. From the back seat, Travis said,
"Cows would be cool."
Gavin sighed.
"The depth of my patience amazes me."
He got out of the Land Rover and went to the man-sized door in the barn, which was adjacent to the larger double doors that would have admitted a tractor pulling a hay wagon if they had still functioned. He didn't bother trying the door or knocking. Cornell was alerted electronically the moment any vehicle drove onto his property, and concealed in the knotholes of the weather-grade siding were cameras by which he was even now studying his visitor, assuming he was here rather than in his bunker. Although the door appeared flimsy, with corroded hinges and a simple gravity latch, it was solid and equipped with an electronic lock that Cornell could engage or release from a control panel in the main room. A buzz, a clunk, and the door swung open. Gavin stepped into a 5-foot square, unfurnished vestibule with white walls. Directly ahead, a metal door. Above the door, a camera. The outer door closed. The inner one opened. He stepped into the main room, and the second door swung shut behind him. The truth of the building was not the dilapidated barn that enclosed it like a shell. The one and only room, other than the vestibule and a small water closet, was this 40-foot square space with a 12-foot ceiling. The barn was anchored to this solidly constructed building that stood within it. Here, Cornell passed most days, retreating at night to the bunker, which Gavin had never seen, and to which this place was connected by a hidden underground passageway. Bookshelves entirely lined three walls and part of the fourth, almost 1,300 linear feet of shelving. There didn't appear to be room left for a single new volume. Along the portion of the fourth wall not devoted to books, there were the door through which Gavin had entered and the door to the water closet, as well as a kitchenette with cupboard, counter space, a double sink, two big refrigerators, two microwaves, and an oven. On the concrete floor were four area carpets, on which stood an amazing variety of chairs and recliners, no two pieces of the same style or period, in configurations that made sense only to Cornell. Each seating option was served by a matching footstool and a side table with either a lamp or a floor lamp. The light filtered through either stained glass or blown glass, or colored and cut crystal, or pleated silk, or treated parchment. Every lamp glowed, so Cornell was able to move, at any moment, from one chair to another and continue reading without interruption. The many lamps cast mostly soft pools of amber or rose light, but also two blue pools and two green, in a large room that remained shadowed in many places. Although there was nothing in this windowless space that Gavin had not seen elsewhere and often, the effect was otherworldly, as if this were not a building, but instead a capsule untethered from the known world, adrift in time, where the readers of these books were hobbits or creatures equally quaint. For all its strangeness, the big room was cozy, welcoming, even as it was magical and richly bejeweled by the lamps. The one and only reader who ever placed a bookmark between any two of these millions of pages looked entirely human, although his appearance had changed since Gavin's most recent visit. Cornell Jasperson, 6'9", more than half a foot taller than his cousin, stood beside a wingback armchair in a circle of four mismatched armchairs that faced one another. Milk chocolate brown rather than black, he was a long-boned, knob-jointed scarecrow with enormous hands, whose body suggested menace and a knowledge of violence that qualified him for a role in movies that featured lonely places where the silence of the night was broken by the roar of a chainsaw. His face seemed misplaced on that body, round and smooth and sweet, with dark eyes that radiated intelligence and kindness, a countenance that might have gotten him cast to play Jesus. All of that was Cornell, as Gavin had long known him, but never before had the man's head been as smooth and hairless as an egg. Gavin stopped 3 feet from his kin, and neither attempted to hug him nor offered to shake hands. Cornell could tolerate being touched, but the experience always took a toll on him. Years earlier, to avoid a lifelong need to see a dentist and be touched by one, Cornell had gone through 2 lengthy appointments with an understanding periodontist, in the first of which, under anesthesia, he had all his teeth pulled and titanium posts embedded in his jawbones. After a few months of healing, during a subsequent appointment, his new teeth were installed permanently over the titanium posts. Goodbye decay, goodbye gum disease, goodbye regular teeth cleaning.
"What happened to the dreadlocks?" Gavin asked now.
Cornell's voice matched his face, not his body.
"In a book I was reading, there was a mention of Mr. Bob Marley being dead."
"He's been dead a long time."
"I didn't know."
"Convey my condolences to the family, please and thank you." "So I would wake up in the middle of the night and think of Mr. Bob Marley lying in a coffin, and it felt like I was wearing a dead man's hair, so I shaved it off." "Does that sound odd to you?"
"Yes, it does," Gavin said.
Cornell nodded.
I thought it would. You didn't grow the dreadlocks because of Bob Marley. No, that's right. I didn't. So you could have kept them. No, not once I knew he was dead.
Cornell had heard only one Bob Marley song and had been badly affected by it. Reggae made him feel as if ants were crawling over every square inch of his body. He listened to orchestral pieces, preferably with a lot of strings, but mostly to Mr. Paul Simon, whose voice sounds like it belongs to a friend I've always known.
Remember I told you the day might come when Jesse and I needed to stay for some time in the little blue house out there? And I said, okay, sure, no skin off my rose.
You did,
and I'm grateful for that.
Gavin never knew if his cousin's occasional malapropisms were unintentional or for some reason amused him. Maybe he meant to say nose and it just came out rose, though there was a twinkle in his eye that suggested he was playing some sly game. Whatever the case, Gavin never corrected him.
Well, it's that time, Cornell, and I need to explain a little, so you'll have some idea what you're getting into. Can we sit down to talk, please and thank you?
Of course. Patting the back of the chair beside which he stood, Cornell said,
This is my chair right now.
He indicated the other three armchairs in the circle.
You can sit in any of those. And if you can't decide, I can pick one for you.
I'll take the leather club chair.
That's a good one. That's a fine chair.
As he folded into the wingback, Cornell seemed to have extra knee and elbow joints. He interlaced his fingers and propped his hands on his stomach and smiled.
So is it the end of all things come round at last, like I told you it would?
Not quite, Gavin said. 14. Because they are busy on one assignment after another in California, Nevada, and Arizona, Carter Jurgen and Radley DuBose live for the most part in hotels. They are highly valued by their Arcadian superiors. They are technically, if not actually, agents of the National Security Agency, Homeland Security, the FBI, the CIA, and the Environmental Protection Agency, collecting 5 salaries and accumulating 5 pensions, with special status emblazoned across the top of their various photo IDs. Because of that special status, and the fact that their expenses are divided among 5 agencies, considering also that a cleverly jiggled accounting program channels 30% of their combined expenditures onto the books of the Department of Education and the Department of Energy under the heading Office Supplies, they can be confident that the government will pay for transportation, accommodations, dining, and incidentals of the highest quality. During the Shukla operation, and one that came before it, and now that the Washington matter has been assigned to them, they have 2 ocean view rooms at the Ritz-Carlton Laguna Niguel, which isn't in Laguna Niguel, as its name would imply, but in Dana Point. Laguna Niguel just sounds classier. After the fiasco in the desert, Jurgen and DuBose had been airlifted out to Capistrano Beach and driven from there to the hotel. They had gone to bed at 3:30 a.m. Exhausted, Jurgen intends to sleep at least until noon. His room phone rings at 7:15. When he doesn't answer it, the smartphone in the charger on the nightstand rings. When he fails to answer that, his room phone rings again, and he ignores it. He has almost drifted back into a dream when the room's ceiling light comes on and Radley DuBose says,
I know you Boston Brahmins need your beauty sleep, but you're already pretty boy enough. Get your ass in gear.
Jurgen sits up in bed.
How the hell did you get in here? Are you serious? Have you forgotten who we are and what we do? Come on, partner. Every hour we delay, the colder the trail gets.
There is no trail.
There's always one. We get the Washingtons and the kid, or we have a black mark by our names in the big book of the Revolution. I haven't showered yet. You have 5 minutes.
I can't shower in 5 minutes.
Then I'll carry you into the bathroom, turn on the water, and soap you down myself.
Throwing back the cover.